democratically elected government. So why is the Tel Aviv regime meddling in the DRC? This is one of the questions our expert will be answering. The second part of our program will be on some of the challenges Africa faces in improving energy access as it seeks to industrialize. So stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis.
Mossad meddling in the DRC. The former chief of Israel's Mossad spy agency, Yossi Cohen, was humiliated after he was deported from the Democratic Republic in 2019. According to media reports, his ejection from Kinshasa came after the country's president obtained classified reports that the Mossad chief was planning a coup against him. The expose on the Israeli regime's plot to overthrow DRC's government comes when the regime has been lobbying to be an observer member of the African Union.
Leading Pan-Africanist Pierre Lumumba in voicing his opposition to the Israeli regime's observer status at the AU said the Tel Aviv regime might be pursuing hidden objectives in its attempt to infiltrate Africa.
I find no merit in Israel enjoying observer status at the African Union. And thirdly, I am puzzled why that is important at all. I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU, unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Well, for more on the Israeli regime's meddling in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Kambale Musavuli, a human rights activist and an analyst at the Center for Research on the Congo. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, can you give us a brief account on what led to the humiliating expulsion of the Mossad spy agency chief in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
We know that Congo, the Congolese president, became very close to Israel. I believe that he felt that by becoming close to Israel, that would give him some cover to rule the Congo and control the country. But it was a surprise to him that while he was close to Israel, there was something else happening. The first visit is unclear of when it took place. The second visit, we know, took place on October 9th of 2019. Right when the president of the Congo was traveling to the eastern part of the country. And it's very important to look at that context. The head of Mossad came into the DRC when the president of the Congo was traveling to the east, and at the same time, the same day he was traveling to the east, one of the planes with Congolese soldiers and some of his vehicles, the bulletproof vehicles and so on, got into an accident, right? There was a plane crash of the presidential convoy. So that raised a lot of suspicion about why the Mossad head was in DRC unannounced twice already without the country knowing why he was coming there.
During his visit to Kinshasa, the Mossad chief was in the company of Gertler, one of former President Joseph Kabila's closest business cronies. This corrupt Zionist wheeler dealer is said to have bribed Congolese authorities to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars in exchange for mining rights in the DRC. Gertler recently signed a deal with the current government in Kinshasa that would allow the DRC to recover looted mining and oil assets of Gertler's company Ventura worth more than $2 billion. That's a colossal amount of money looted from a country with some of the poorest people on earth. Is Mossad involved in the looting of DRC's wealth?
The New York Times had an expose that explained who Doug Gertler was. Cohen traveling to DRC with Dan Gertler may be a shock to people. But we in the DRC, especially at the Center for Research of the Congo, we have studied for quite some time Dan Gertler's dealing in the DRC. We're not that surprised. He's a very powerful businessman in the DRC. He's made billions of dollars on shady deals in the DRC. And in the New York Times expose that I'm referencing, it was clearly stated that he's an intelligence asset for Mossad and serves for U.S. national interests in Central Africa.
The Israeli regime has close ties with the former and current DRC president, and this has raised questions on what Cohen was really pursuing in Kinshasa. Now, is it possible that different Israeli regime factions are competing for the control of the DRC, especially since the current president, Felix Tshisekedi, who was reportedly almost deposed by Mossad, also enjoys close ties with the Israeli regime?
The engagement of Felix to Israel has been to continue the policies of his predecessors, of using Israel as the space or the country for access for intelligence tools. Some of the Israeli companies have been engaged in the Congo. NSO, that pretty much manufactured or created the Pegasus virus. NSO is still operating in DRC. There is no indication that they have stopped under the Tshisekedi regime. We know there are other Israeli interests there. But the most important under the Felix regime, the most important engagement is that under his regime and under his the Congo being the chairman of the African Union, the DRC played a central role with the chairperson of the AU Commission to recognize Israel as a member state of the African Union. So that's why Israel needed the DRC.
The Israeli regime had close military links with the apartheid regime in South Africa and Rwanda during the 1994 genocide. The regime has also been selling weapons, fueling civil wars in several African countries. Now, the Israeli regime is literally plundering the resources of the Democratic Republic of Congo, widely considered to be the richest country in the world in terms of natural resources. Considering the foregoing, can we say that the African Union should categorically reject the Israeli regime's attempt to become an observer member?
I mean, the decision for Israel to become an observatory member of the African Union did not come from the African people. Now, African people have always been on the side of the Palestinian people. The African Union has put a statement denouncing the apartheid that the Palestinian people live in, that's imposed on them by Israel. So we, the African people, are very clear about what the Palestinian people are living. What took place was an undemocratic process of electing or pretty much imposing on the African people the status of Israel within the African Union.
It is quite interesting that the Israeli regime sought to oust DRC's president and at the same time used him in its attempt to gain observer status at the African Union. Now, very briefly as we wind up, should this be a warning bell to African leaders that they cannot trust the Tel Aviv regime?
Those leaders on the African continent who are supporting Israel, behind their backs, Israel is plotting a coup in the case of the Congo, while the Congolese president is supporting Israel. The head of intelligence of Israel, Cohen, allegedly was plotting a coup in DRC. That's a signal for those leaders who are supporting Israel that they may even turn against you. So they should be on the side of the African people, of supporting the people of Palestine, demanding that the Palestinians can return on their land, control their own affairs, and live peacefully and freely in the land like any human being should live.
Well, we'd like to thank Mr. Kambale Musavoli of the Center for Research on the Congo for his incisive analysis. Now we now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall be talking about the status of the access to electricity in Africa. Stay with us.
Lighting up Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Poor electricity access is one of the biggest developmental challenges facing many African countries. Millions of people across the continent live in complete darkness, unable to access electricity for basic household use such as lighting, charging phones, and laptops.
In their recent book titled The Challenge of Energy Access in Africa, authors Manfred Hafner, Simone Talia Pietra, and Lucia de Strasser identified four major problems militating against energy access on the continent. Decades of neglect in building up countrywide infrastructure, a lack of international investment, poor regulatory frameworks, and difficulties surrounding bankability of power projects.
According to the Africa Development Bank, over 640 million Africans have no access to energy, corresponding to an electricity access rate for African countries at just over 40%, the lowest in the world. Now, the president of the Africa Development Bank Group, Akinwumi Adesina, says lack of electricity is killing industries in Nigeria, Africa's largest economy.
You see, ladies and gentlemen, a lack of electricity is killing Nigerian industries. Something Chief Odutola was concerned about way back in 1971. According to the Manufacturers Association of Nigeria, industries spend $93.1 billion, a billion naira, I must say, on alternative energy in 2018. That is 47 years after Chief Odutola. Today, no business can survive in Nigeria without generators. Consequently, the abnormal has become normal.
Well, for more on the state of electricity supply in Africa, we contacted Lawrence Freeman, a political economic analyst for Africa. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Okay.
Now, why is access to electricity the biggest development challenge facing many African countries, yet the continent is home to vast energy resources?
The problem is that the African nations have never been able to build up the infrastructure, of which energy is the most important feature, for their economies. Don't forget, since the emergence of the African nations in the 1960s, there has been, from the West, a refusal to help these nations actually develop by making investments in infrastructure, by making investments in energy. All kinds of aid has been delivered, and all kinds of speeches have been made. And the lack of energy in Africa is literally killing Africa, not figuratively, but literally, because you can't have an industrialized economy without energy. And if you don't have an industrialized economy, people live in poverty and die.
South Africa, Africa's second largest economy, has the highest energy consumption on the continent. Yet unscheduled power outages are on the increase. The country's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, last year announced another project to deal with the country's energy crisis.
Through this Hydrogen South Africa strategy, government and its partners have successfully deployed hydrogen fuel cells to provide electricity in some of our schools, and to build hospitals established as part of the country's COVID-19 response.
North Africa seems to be relatively well off compared to sub-Saharan Africa in terms of access to electricity. What is the situation in African countries such as Nigeria and South Africa?
Across sub-Saharan Africa, not counting the Maghreb, in sub-Saharan Africa, the lack of energy is pervasive and deadly. And there's no country. Look, there's only 100 to 110,000 megawatts of power capacity for over a billion people in sub-Saharan Africa. 40,000 is produced in South Africa, but South Africa doesn't have enough energy. And you have other countries like Nigeria, which are living on less than 100 watts of electricity per capita. So there is no good news story. There is no one, there's no country who's delivering energy and not even close to the energy that's needed. My estimates are we need 1,000 gigawatts of electricity, and all we have is 100,000 megawatts. So the deficit is striking.
Ethiopia's Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is said to be the largest hydroelectric scheme in Africa, but has been at the center of regional dispute. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed officially inaugurated electricity production from the country's mega dam on the Blue Nile in February.
Now, Mr. Freeman, what impact will the Ethiopia dam have on efforts to ensure greater access to electricity in African countries?
The most significant development is Ethiopia has a Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD. And they embarked on this about 10 years ago. And within the next month or two, they will be involved in the third filling of this dam. This will be the largest dam on the continent of Africa. It will have a reservoir of about 74 billion cubic meters, estimated to generate over 6,000 megawatts. Now, this will be a significant increase for Ethiopia, and they will also export energy to the region, Kenya, South Sudan, maybe Tanzania. But it's still not enough, but it's a big development.
Now, although many in other continents are moving towards nuclear energy, South Africa remains the only African country that generates nuclear energy. Other countries such as Nigeria, Egypt, and Kenya have plans to set up nuclear power plants. Now, do you think nuclear energy can be an option for Africa?
You have about 16 or 17 African countries in various phases of acquiring nuclear energy, which would be the best for Africa, and it's the best form of energy. Egypt, I think, is working with Russia to build several nuclear energy plants. South Africa is embarking on a plan to build possibly four nuclear power plants, and many other countries, Ghana, Nigeria, and others, are in the process of acquiring permits and feasibility studies. This would be a huge increase for Africa to start deploying nuclear energy.
A recent report by Wood Mackenzie Limited says sub-Saharan African countries will need to invest as much as $350 billion between now and 2030 to be able to considerably improve electricity and generation distribution. Now, is this objective achievable in your opinion?
What I've been working on with my African friends is to establish an Africa Infrastructure Development Bank, which would be a bank that would lend out money, credit, for infrastructure, of which energy would be the primary, along with high-speed railroads, would be the most important investments for this infrastructure bank. And the West just turns away a blind eye to the actual needs of Africa and energy. And without energy, you won't solve the food crisis. Without energy, you won't end hunger. Without energy, you won't end poverty, and yet the Western institutions do nothing but complain and feel bad, but they won't make the investment necessary. Russia and China and India will probably do more in providing nuclear energy for Africa than the West.
According to some reports, over 30% of electricity in France generated by uranium for Niger, yet only 1 in 7 Nigerians have access to modern electricity services. Can we say that the exploitation by former colonial powers such as France is a major factor in lack of electricity in Africa?
And it's true, the French, never developed their 14 countries that are part of Francophone arrangements. And they basically are carrying out the colonial policy of taking the resource of uranium to develop their own energy base, nuclear base, and doing nothing to help Niger.
Renewable energy's potential across the African continent remains largely untapped. Now, the president of the Africa Development Bank says the bank is funding renewable energy projects in the continent. Let's take a listen.
Africa has abundant energy resources, including solar, hydro, geothermal, and also wind. The African Development Bank is spearheading investments in renewable energy. And guess what? 85% of all the African Development Bank's investment in energy is in renewable energy.
Now, my last question to Mr. Freeman, what is preventing the wider use of renewable energy sources such as solar, which is readily available across Africa?
Well, it is, and the problem you have is you have a whole colonial mindset which dominates the West. There's a totally different thinking coming from China in particular. The West, in their colonial mindset, have never intended to develop Africa. We have an anti-development mindset, which corresponds in some ways to a colonial mindset. And this continent with all these resources has never been developed, and that's by intention. And that is very sad, and that's what I'm trying to change with my work and my website and my writings and my lectures.
Well, there you have it. Western neocolonial powers led by the United States prefer an underdeveloped Africa so that they can continue looting the continent's resources. That's the opinion of Lawrence Freeman, an expert on African affairs. We'd like to thank him for his insight on the subject. Well, and that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your comments through our social media handle. Take care and goodbye for now.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. I would like to begin this episode with a question. Who was the first person, the very first person who rebelled against Allah? Who was he? You all know. The first person who transgressed and crossed the limits was Shaitan, Satan. He refused to submit to Allah. He rebelled him when, of course, Allah wanted him to obey him. But he rebelled. Shaitan was a good creature in the beginning. He was worshipping Allah. He was submissive. But when Allah put him to a serious test by asking him to show his respect to Adam, he stubbornly refused. He said, "Because I am much better than Adam. Who the heck is Adam? I'm not going to bow to Adam." خلقتني من نار وخلقته من تين. So Shaitan was stubborn, Shaitan was selfish, and Shaitan was proud of himself because he was proud of having been created from fire, while man, insan, was created from mud, from clay. Okay, he was saying, okay, my race is white and his race is black. That's what we are saying nowadays. That's what we see, at least in the world. Some people say, I am European, I'm so and so. I'm not going to respect someone who is poor, who comes from so and so country. So it's all because of selfishness, because of arrogance, because of stubbornness, and because of pride. It's all because of this that he says, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to that to do that. Shaitan was very much, yes, like this. Shaitan did not submit to Allah and he did not obey Allah because he was proud. Allah the Exalted, the Almighty, says the true essence, the true act of worship, ibadah, is that when you are willing to submit to Allah. That's the main essence of ibadah. Worshipping Allah is all about submitting to Allah. Every cell in your body yearns Him, submits to Him, and worships Him. There is a verse in the Quran which says, قُلْ إِنَّ صَلَاتِي وَنُسُكِي وَمَحْيَايَ وَمَمَاتِ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. Say that my prayer, my rituals, my life, and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. So that's all about, ibadah is all about submission. Okay? Not only your actions, your feelings, your aspirations, your sentiments must be directed to Allah. If you love someone, you must love him for the sake of Allah. If you hate something, you should hate for the sake of Allah. Every cell in your body submits to Allah. And that's what submission is about. That's what the religion of Islam is about. Religion has two dimensions, two sides. One is the exterior, which is very visible. Everyone can see the exterior. What is the exterior of faith? Prayers, the fasting, when you don't eat and drink, the Hajj, the charity that you give, and the jihad. These are the exterior of the religion, the outward aspect of the religion. Okay? But the interior of Islam and the essence of Islam is the submission to Allah. The inner faith and belief in Islam, which is invisible to the eyes, that is the true essence. The true essence of Islam is submission. And you have to believe that when it comes to Allah, you are nothing but subservient to Allah, the Almighty. You submit to Allah willfully, truly, utterly, and completely. And you are subservient to Allah with all your heart, body, and soul.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Man reaches a degree of belief where he declares his nothingness before Allah. That is the true faith. That is the true faith. This is how you measure your faith. This is a scale on which you put your faith and you measure it. Okay? And you see whether you really have faith. And if you have faith, do you have 50% faith, complete faith, or incomplete faith? Or you have no faith at all? Okay? In fact, this is the essence. This is the meaning of love. When you love someone, you are prepared to do everything for him. You are willing to do everything for him. If he tells you to call him before going to bed, you call him. If he tells you to call him every 30 minutes, you call him. If he tells you to pick him from the street, you would do so. If he tells you, wait for me in the street in the cold, you will definitely do it, as people do it. We can see it. If he tells you to wait for him in the road and it's raining, you will do that. You will never say no to him because you love that person. Prophet Sulaiman saw an ant in the desert carrying some dust from one end to another. Sulaiman, who had the ability of communicating with animals and insects, said, "What are you doing there?" The ant said, "I'm carrying dust from this side to the other side." He said, "Why are you doing this?" She said, "I am in love. I am in deep love with someone who asked me to do so, and I'm just listening to him." Sulaiman said to her, "But the dust here is too much, and this is a big mountain of dust. You will not be able to carry all the dust even if you live the life of Noah. Are you going to spend all your life doing this? You're going to die soon or late. You cannot do that." She said to him, "Ya Sulaiman, dying in the way of love and in the line of duty towards someone you love is much better and comforting for you." "Yes, even if I die, it does not matter because I'm dying for him." Sulaiman received the message that even in our death, we have to die for our Lord, the Glorified. قُلْ إِنَّ صَلَاتِي وَنُسُكِي وَمَحْيَايَ وَمَمَاتِ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. Of course, not only your activities and prayers, but your death should also be for him. Your life and death, your beginning and your end should be for him. That is the true essence of faith. We live for Allah and completely submit to him. فَلَا وَرَبَّكَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ حَتَّى يُحَكِّمُوكَ فِي مَا شَجَرْ بَيْنَهُمْ ثُمَّ لَا يَجِدُ فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَرَجًا مِمَّا قَضَيْتَ وَيَسَلِّمُ تَسْلِيمًا. But know, by your Lord, they do not believe in reality until they make you a judge of that which has become a matter of disagreement among them. And this is the translation of the verse. And then do not find any straightness in their hearts as to what you have decided, and submit with entire submission. And that's the end of this episode. Inshallah, we will carry on this discussion. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. Love is all I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode. And you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, in which we shall discuss some very controversial issues. Well, without further ado, I would like to go directly into the main of discussion. But before that, I would like to introduce my guest. Welcome, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm so happy to meet you here again.
My pleasure.
So here with us, we have Dr. Karimi. And in this episode, we're going to discuss some debatable questions. So stay tuned. Well, today's question is related to love and marriage, which asks, love has to happen after marriage or not? Does it have to happen only after marriage, or is it possible for love to happen before marriage? Is it acceptable?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So basically the question somehow is against the concept of, some of the Islamic laws. According to Islamic laws, we do not believe in the boyfriend-girlfriend relations before them being mahram to each other. And after reciting the contract of marriage, they are mahram to each other. So They say that this is against the concept of love.
And just to explain for the audience the concept of mahram, shall you please give us a brief explanation?
Yeah, according to the religion of Islam, mahram is referring, when it comes to a man and woman, the mahram women are the ladies who do not need to cover themselves in front of that man. So it includes, for example, his mother, his daughters, his sisters, his aunts, and some other
those
people.
Those who have a blood relation or they have been married to them.
Yeah. Of course, not all the people through blood relations.
Yes, yes.
You have all these details mentioned in the books of jurisprudence. Now, the question says that, okay, according to the religion of Islam, you say that boys and girls cannot have any kind of relation to each other. So they need to get married, and then they can be mahram to each other and have relation, which means that before they love each other, they need to get married. But there is no guarantee that when they get married, they would love each other. So somehow this Islamic law is against the concept of love, if we may put it this way.
Yes.
Now, the first point is that, is there a guarantee that those people who loved each other and then they got married, they will be...
Continue loving each other after marriage
or not? Is there any guarantee? Because these people are looking for a guarantee for love after marriage.
But of course, nothing in life has guarantee.
Nothing has guarantee. So the first point is that not all the people, we are not against the concept of love. We have so many narrations about the concept of love in our books of narrations, and the ways that the wife and husband needs to express their love toward each other, toward their children, and so on and so forth. But my point is that there is no guarantee that those people who love, as boyfriend and girlfriend, they love each other and then they get married, but they remained as loving each other after marriage. There is no guarantee. And I think statistics tell us that in many cases also they ended up in divorce as well.
Exactly.
Even people who loved each other before getting married. So it's not a way to undermine the Islamic laws to just say that there is no guarantee. There is no guarantee even for BFGF relations as well after marriage. The second question is that if we may think of two options, a marriage based on cognition and knowledge and a marriage based on love, which one is preferred? According to the religion of Islam, first and foremost, marriage should be based on understanding and logic and recognizing each other. Of course, love matters, but before that, what matters the most is to know each other.
The person himself or herself.
But unfortunately, what matters in boyfriend and girlfriend relations is that they love each other and they do not see the faults and the deficiencies. And that is why when they get married, they live together. Just then they come to know the realities of each other.
They don't look beyond the person who they are seeing right now.
That's the point. So Islam says that before getting married, go to know each other. And there are many ways. Islam is not promoting the idea of getting married with blind eyes and with a boy and a girl that do not know anything about that. No,
they have
not
no
at
idea
all.
About each other.
Yeah, in the past we have some so-called traditional families who may have done so. But this is not the Islamic way
exactly.
of getting married.
Exactly, it was tradition. It wasn't about the religion.
It was a tradition, and maybe some people thought that this is Islamic, but this is not Islamic. Mm-hmm. This is anti-Islamic. So before marriage, you need to know each other. But does it necessarily mean that this knowledge should be through boyfriend-girlfriend relation? Islam says that no, you can know each other through some ways. One way can be, for example, talking to each other, but the families know about.
They are all aware of what's going on.
They all are aware of that. So when it is done under the control of the families, it means that
no one would get hurt.
Exactly. And all these bad stories that we hear, none of them will happen. So through these dialogue sessions, if you may call it dialogue sessions, boys and girls, they come to know each other. Without touching, of course, they are non-mahram to each other.
They would get the headlines about each other.
Exactly. And they will come to this understanding whether they can match each other or not. And through that, love may happen too. So if they come to this understanding that they match each other, love can happen before marriage too. Mm-hmm.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So my point is that Islam emphasizes on knowing each other before marriage and not on
just love,
which according to these people requires relation, without being mahram to each other. Islam is against that. Islam is against such relations which are done without the fathers and the parents.
And I guess it's for the benefit of those people. It has been said that way for the benefit of the girl, mostly girls and also boys, because no one would get heartbroken.
Exactly. That's the point. And even another solution for some people, it may help. Some Muslim families also, they try that. And that is the concept of temporary marriage that we have it in Islam. Of course, our Sunni brothers believe that it is only a Shia concept, but we believe that it's in an Islamic. But anyway, for some families, they say that, okay, this boy and girl, they want to know more each other. And we do not want them to fall in committing sins. So they can be mahram to each other for a couple of weeks, for example, for a couple of months through this concept of contemporary marriage. So even they may, for example, touch each other, but within the limits, but through that they may come to a kind of more understanding. So this is, of course, this is not suggested for all the people. For some families, they may think that if they recite the contract of temporary marriage, it can help the boy and the girl not to commit any sin. And after, of course, it shouldn't be too long. All
exactly,
the scholars,
that's the point. Should,
because some people go through this religion for a couple of years and then, so, I mean, you do not need so much time to come to know each other, to be realistic.
It doesn't take that long
it
to know a person.
And at the end of the day, you will not know each other
exactly
before
going under
each other.
The same
this
roof.
Is, exactly. This is a reality. But anyway, this is a solution for some people who want to know each other more and maybe to be away from any kind of sin, but more practically maybe to, talk to each other, but with the control of the families.
Within limits.
Within limits. It helps a lot. The next point is that, as I mentioned, Islam is a pro-love religion, and we have so many narrations in this regard. Islam, especially when it comes to the men, the husbands, encourages them a lot to express their love toward their wives. So we shouldn't think that, okay, this is, Islam is a religion which is against the concept of love. No, this is not the reality. In one tradition, one of the infallible says that, قول الرجل لمراته, if a man tells his wife that I love you, it will not be removed from her heart at all. So Islam emphasizes on the concept of love.
But after marriage.
After marriage, of course. This is one point. And the second point is that love has some, levels. So I believe that if a marriage is based on knowledge, which Islam emphasizes on a lot, then love happens naturally speaking too. Especially if we take into consideration the Islamic advices in this regard. Like for example, saying your feelings, like buying gifts,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. So if a life of the spouses are based on Islamic laws, and before that the marriage is based on knowing each other, on recognition, on cognition and knowledge, I believe that love will also be there, gradually speaking. And of course, no one can say that this is love and this is not love.
Mm-hmm.
It has levels, it has stages. So, and of course we need to also say that there are some practical ways for increasing our love. There are some practical ways. For example, in this case, we have some narrations and we have some advices by the psychologists, for example. We need to spend time if we want to have a life based on love. We need to be together, as
it takes time to buy a heart.
Exactly, that's the point. And to express your love is very important, especially for men out there. Many of them, they are not ready to express their love. Of course, deep in their heart, they love. But Islam says that, no, it's not enough. Just express your love. Women like to hear that from you.
Mm-hmm.
So to put it in a nutshell, we mentioned that this question somehow is trying to mention that Islam is against the concept of love, and the marriage based on love is guaranteed, but Islam says that there is no way to love each other before marriage. We said that, first of all, is there any guarantee that boyfriends and girlfriends who love each other
end up happily?
End up in having a long life with love? No. In many cases, it doesn't continue
like
that.
They fall into divorce.
Yeah. And we said that Islam puts emphasis on marriage based on knowing each other. And we believe that a marriage based on knowing is much better than a marriage which is only based on love,
mm-hmm.
without knowing each other. And Islam has many ways for knowing each other. Like, as we said, talking under the control of the
families
and the parents. And in some cases, maybe being mahram for a short time. And third, we said that Islam, when you get married, Islam has so many ways for advancing love among the spouses, like expressing, like buying gifts, and so on and so forth.
So, as we see, Islam is not against love, but what happens is that it is against forbidden relationships, exactly, which is going to hurt both sides, the girls and the boys. After all, I would say thank you for listening. This was all the time that we had for today. Until another session, I bid you farewell and I leave you to the protection of God.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Glimpses of Imam Reza's dynamic life. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations on a very auspicious day, in whose blessings Iran and the faithful all over the world are basking. As you know, today is the 11th of the sacred month of Dhul-Qa'dah, the day on which, in the year 148 AH, corresponding to 766 AD, Imam Reza, peace upon him, was born in Medina, the city of his illustrious ancestor, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He was the Prophet's 8th infallible heir, and during his 20-year period of Imamat, he ably guided the seekers of truth to the shores of salvation, despite the harassment to which he was subjected by three tyrannical Abbasid caliphs, the last of whom, Ma'mun, forcibly brought him to Marv in Khorasan, and against his will, declared him the heir apparent of the Islamic realm in order to mislead the Muslim masses into thinking that the ruler was respecting the Immaculate Ahlul Bayt, and then had him secretly martyred through a dose of poison. Stay with us for a special feature on the life and times of Imam Reza, peace upon him, whose holy shrine in Mashhad is the most sacred spot on the soil of Iran. But before that, we recite to you Ayah 36 of Surah Nur, which reads, "In houses Allah has allowed to be raised and wherein His name is celebrated, He is glorified therein morning and evening." When this ayah was revealed by God through Archangel Gabriel, the Prophet expounded its meaning to his companions.
According to a narration found in the books of Hadith of our Sunni brethren, Abu Bakr asked whether the house of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon them, was also among the houses exalted by Allah. The Messenger of Mercy replied in affirmation and added that it is the best of houses. Alas, today the godless Wahhabis have destroyed not just the house of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima, peace upon them, along with the entire Bani Hashim locality in Medina, but their blasphemous bulldozers have left no trace of the house where the Prophet of Islam, whom God calls Mercy unto the entire creation, was born in Mecca. The question that arises is that by such ungodly acts that are not less in profanity than the periodical sacrilege to which some satanic minds in the West resort against the sanctities of Islam through films, journals, and novels, have the Wahhabis succeeded in obliterating from Muslim minds the hallowed status of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, whose spotless purity God Almighty Himself has vouched in the Noble Quran in Ayah 33 of Surah Zab? The answer is a big no. The facts are all too obvious. A house is not just a place where a person is born and lives, but also the final resting place, or, in other words, the grave which houses his or her body. To be more precise, the ayah of Surah Nur that we recited includes, without the least doubt, the holy shrines of the Ahlul Bayt, where day and night the name of God Almighty is glorified, and which are indeed the most exalted abodes anywhere in the world. One such hallowed house is in Iran, in the city of Mashhad, which is now hosting millions of Muslims from not just all over the Islamic Republic, but from different parts of the globe. It is the shrine of the Prophet's 8th infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him, who was, as we said earlier, born on the 11th of Dhul-Qa'dah in the year 148 AH, in his now destroyed house in Medina, but who through immortal martyrdom found a permanent place in Khorasan that leads the believers to the celestial heavens. Imam Reza, peace upon him, needs no introduction. His father was Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, who rests in peace in Kazemain near Baghdad, where he was martyred through poisoning by the tyrant Harun al-Rashid. His grandfather, as Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, the reviver of the Prophet's pristine practice and behavior, Sunnah and Sirah, which is known today all over the world as Fiqhul Ja'fariya. The 8th Imam's mother was the virtuous lady from North Africa, Toktam, also called Najme Khatun. In 183 AH, the divine mantle of Imamat came to rest on the shoulders of Imam Reza, peace upon him, who ably discharged the duties entrusted to him by God Almighty in guiding the people. He himself was a paragon of virtues and ethics, without the slightest blemish in his impeccable character. As mentioned by the famous narrator of the Hadith, the Iranian scholar Sheikh Muhammad ibn Babwei Saduq, who lived over a millennium ago, in the words of Ibrahim ibn Abbas, "I never saw Ali Reza committing excess over anyone in talking and interrupting anybody's speech before its coming to the end. He did not stretch his legs in the presence of others. When the meal table was laid, he invited the servants to it and took his meals with them. After taking rest in the nights, he got up and made himself busy with the prayers to Allah. Similar to his forefathers, he carried food to the houses of the afflicted ones at the mid of nights.